I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Thanks, Ken. It's good to be back here with you again.
Anything in particular you'd like to talk about this week?
Yeah, there are probably a few things we should talk about this week, Ken. Perhaps first, just a quick update on the app that we've spoken about in earlier podcasts. Everything has now been uploaded to iTunes, according to my IT whiz, and we're just waiting on Apple to simply make it public so everyone can have access to it. Now, if that doesn't happen today or tomorrow, it should certainly be available next week. Anyway, if it's early in the week, we can certainly send around everyone a special alert so that they can go and grab their copy. Now, as for the mentor program, it's also probably about a week away. Everything seems to be coming together, just a couple of last-minute items that need to be put into place before I can open up enrolments for the initial intake. And as I said, there's only going to be a limited number there because we want to make sure first we get it right, but also, obviously, I don't want to spread myself too thin so that, you know, those that join aren't getting value for what they're expecting.
Last week, we explored step one of your investment formula in a lot more depth. Now, I realise step two involves using your final judgment software to distill about 20 variables down into just a single figure for easy comparison. And that software is obviously being made available to those joining your mentor program. But I thought you might care to explain the logic behind the time frame you adopt when creating your projected cash flows.
My final judgment software is really pretty intuitive as far as the user's concerned with everything that you need to input. But behind the scenes, it's quite complex and sophisticated with what it can actually do. And the reason it's been made user-friendly is mainly because I'm the one that's designed it as a marketer, and it's not been put together by a techo. Sure, we need their input to do the technical side, but if you leave it to a techo to design it, all they are seeking to do is try and make it as simple for them as they can, and they're not really interested in the user's interface and how that is itself intuitive. So as I said, it's powerful, but it's got, like, there's a number of other programs which are somewhat laborious out there. Yes, as I said, they're powerful, but what they tend to do is to stretch their projections out over an 8 to 10 year time frame. You know, I'm all about the simplicity for the user, and having software which provides you with real life guidance. And you see, 10 years is just far too long a period over which you try and do a projected cash flow. Now, I don't know about you, but I threw my crystal ball away quite a few years ago, and no one can realistically look past about 4 years going forward. Now, you've got to also remember that you need to take into account your upfront purchase costs. You've got stamp duty and other acquisitions costs, legal fees, valuations, due diligence, etc., and also your selling costs. And I'm talking about commission, advertising, and legal expenses, and so forth. Now, with my software, the final judgment software, what I recommend you do is to aim for a minimum of a 10% after-tax return over a four-year period. Now, obviously, your return is going to look a whole lot better when you take it over a longer period or holding period. But the thing is that you need to go into every deal knowing that it makes sense over a four-year period when your entry and exit costs are the highest. Now, you know, it's important that you look at it on that basis, because it's misleading, or what's the word I'm looking for, providing you with false comfort to have a return of 15 to 20% when you look at it over an 8 to 10 year period. because your incidence of entry and exit costs are spread over 10 years instead of four. And I am a great believer that a four-year period is about what you want to look at. So if it makes sense, and I mean, an after-tax yield of 10%, depending on your tax rate, is something like a 14 to 16 or 17% before tax return. So it's not too shabby. So 10% as a minimum is your benchmark. Invariably, you'll find they come out at around about 11 to 13% after tax over a four-year period. So those are the properties. And the properties we're talking about analysing are those that have already gone through your what we're providing the app for, your initial shortlisting to make sure that you're putting them into further consideration based on strict criteria, which are unemotional. But those that actually make it to your shortlist, and look, there may only be two or three that legitimately get on the shortlist, they're the ones that you take through to the final judgment software. And so you analyse them, calculate your internal rate of return. And the beauty with that is that if you have a property worth, say, $600,000 to $800,000, and I suggest that you wouldn't be using the software if it's less than, you know, $750,000. But you can compare a property worth $750,000 with one worth $5 million, because you can calculate this internal rate of return, which distills everything down into that single after-tax return on the equity that you have invested. You may, if it's a $5 million property, say, well, I'm going to raise my minimum of 10% up to, say, 11 or 12 as your benchmark, but still it provides you with a very simple, very quick basis for analysis. But as I said, I tend to use 4 years as the minimum period, or sorry, the maximum period more particularly, over which I make that projected cash flow, partly for accuracy of the projections, but also to give you a realistic view of what your actual return on equity is.
Should our listeners consider their purchases as set and forget investments? I mean, simply be placed into the filing cabinet?
You know, I quite often have a lot of people tell me, look, they've now bought the property, done all the hard work, and they're simply going to file the lease and all the documentation in their filing cabinet. And look, I mean, you can understand why they do it. You know, they've got a solid tenant. It's an 8 to 10 year lease. There's regular rent reviews with annual increases. I mean, why wouldn't you? I mean, it almost seems like a no-brainer. Well, there's probably two reasons. The first one is an interesting one, and I don't know what the magic of 4 years, and in part that's why I do my analysis, as I discussed with the software, over a four-year period. But as I said, I don't know what the magic of 4 years is, but generally in that 3 to 5 year period, years after ownership, people either get married, they get divorced, they're transferred overseas, they have another child, or there's generally the family circumstances change. And it's quite often that there is a need to realise on the property. And so what I recommend to people is first do your initial analysis over 4 years, so you know if push comes to shove, you can and sell and make money. But also, I would counsel you to have a mandatory four-year review of your portfolio, and you make a conscious decision to continue to hold the property. In other words, it's not a matter of do we sell it? No, you've got to convince yourself why you should hold it. In other words, if you can't convince yourself, well, then the property ought to be sold, because it's just not doing its job within your portfolio. And I mean, you don't want to be an accumulator of properties. You want to be an owner of properties that are actually performing and making money for you. Now, the second reason is this set and forget philosophy doesn't work is because you have to always be mindful that you're not out of sync with market cycles. Now, we discussed, I think, in the last podcast or maybe the one before, that in my view, the market is going to peak somewhere around 2019, 2020. Now, if you have we're talking now, let's say you've just bought a property and it's got an 8 year lease to run on it. So in other words, that lease is going to expire in 2021. Now, the issue you've got to confront here is that if you want to hold it the whole way, you're likely to be just past the peak of the cycle. Now, yes, you would have had good cash flow and it would have been a good investment for you up till the time when the lease expires. But you have to think, what if the tenant at the end of that period didn't exercise their option and didn't stay on? You then have a vacant property in a not so good market. And so you probably would have been better to sell the property in, say, 2017 or 2018, when A, you've still got a good tenant, B, you've got 4 or 5 years to run on the lease, and given the tenant's been a performer all the way along, it has maybe a couple of further 5-year options. It's a rising market. The incoming purchaser looks at it and says, well, I've got a solid tenant, most likely to exercise their options. Gee, the market's good. There's four years to run on the lease. What a great investment. Now, you might say, well, if I'd hung on for another couple of years, I still could have got, you know, those last 2 years in the cycle. Well, that's true, but you would have been 2 years closer to the expiry. So even at just before the peak in 2020 or early 2020, let's say, you are then offering a property with only 2 years to run on the lease, not four, not really as attractive. And so you need to think strategically, and that's why the set and forget philosophy sounds good. And if the tenant does renew their lease, you don't have a problem. But what you would be far better to do is to sell the property, maybe find another property which has a lease that more than straddles that period, because you've got to assume from the end of 2020 through to, say, 2023, maybe 24, there's going to be a slight downturn. I don't know, depends how strong the market reaches its peak. But at least, even if there's a little bit of a downturn, it'll move sideways over that period. So it would be far better to be cashed up in that downturn period, because there's two ways to make money. One is to buy property low and sell high. The other one is to sell high and buy low, because then you automatically lock in your growth. So if you have buy a property in 2021, 22, which may have a very solid tenant, but the purchaser has overcommitted, the market has turned, they have get caught having to pay back their mortgage, which they can't meet, therefore they're under pressure to sell. So you end up buying a very good property, nothing wrong with the property, solid tenant, it's just the vendor is under pressure, and you can then buy after the cycle has peaked and build in or lock in your upward profit moving into the next increase in value.
We probably don't have enough time today to make a sensible start on delving further into step three on negotiating. So do you have any more of those handy tips you've shared at the end of several earlier podcasts?
Okay, let me think. Maybe a few pointers that are going to help to guarantee your investment success. We've already discussed that commercial property is not rocket science, but there are certainly some steps you can follow to improve your probability greatly when going forward. And if we look at the sort of decisions you've got to make, you've got to decide whether your goals are for long-term or short-term. And as we've just discussed, that may be tempered by where you are in the cycle. But there are things you've got to consider, whether you're seeking income or capital growth or both. And I mean, part of this, if everything else adds up, whether you're trying to lock in some good tax savings, and that can be through negative gearing or depreciation. But that then brings us into the next one, and that's what I guess I call the threshold of insomnia. You need to establish what your comfort level is as far as the amount of money you're prepared to borrow. Now, for some people, 80% is fine. There's no issues there. For others, 50% borrowing is all they can live with. So you need to determine that threshold as far as you're concerned, which is effectively the sleep test. The next thing you need to look at is your overall portfolio mix. Now, you need to think about whether you want to focus on just one sector in the commercial property market, in other words, like offices, or do you prefer to spread it across industrial and retail as well? Now, I think last week we talked about why I would rank the sectors as office first, industrial second, and retail a distant third. So you need to think about that. But also, you need to think about the geography, because what you're trying to do is minimise your risk. Now, if you had a split between office and industrial, and I mean, I wouldn't necessarily, well, showrooms sort of are a shandy between industrial and retail. I'd prefer a showroom with a bit of warehouse attached to it than retail, because I think there's a lot more substance in the tenants. It's not fickle. It's not dependent upon consumer spending as much. So I'd look at that. So having a spread across a couple of sectors and having a geographical spread, even within the same city, but in just different suburbs, having a different socioeconomic profile, again, just minimises your risks going forward. Then you've got to think about whether you're going to go it alone or to join with others. We've talked about that a bit on syndication, and I think you probably understand the benefits of doing that. And clearly, if you can get over $1 million as far as a purchase price is concerned, the market certainly thins out as far as competition's concerned. And so you're able to do that. You're able to get up around the sort of 1.5, 2 million, 2.5 million if you can join together with 15 or 20 other like-minded investors. In fact, I think you can probably get up almost about the $4 million, $4.5 million range. And it's then when you have a private syndicate, and we can't go into detail of that now because I think we have covered it before, and I think I made available an ebook to simplify and show you how to do that. But that's another thing you've got to consider. And probably, and I know we might have covered it before, but you've got to sit down and choose the right team of consultants. It's the ability for you to move quickly to snare properties that come available, because vendors will always respond to someone that can make a decision, whether it comes to finance, due diligence, just structuring the deal, all those sort of things. So you need to have your team together so you can quickly assess the value, put the deal together, make sure your contracts are reviewed quickly, your finance is in place, if not the final deal, the indicative deal, and that you can quickly handle the due diligence. And that's what I've tended to do with my clients, to just put them on the front foot as far as putting these deals together and being able to, within a period of, if push comes to shove, we can put a deal together in about 3 to 4 days and know that it'll stick and that's been well investigated, thought through, and that it'll stand you in good stead going forward. And that's what you need to do, and the importance of having a team in place. And you don't wait till you found your first property before lining up your team. If you need help with that, let me know. It's one of the crucial things that will make sure that you are ahead of the pack as far as putting deals together. And this doesn't, it makes you look like a pro, even though you may not be. And if you get the right team, they will flag issues that you won't even have any idea about, because that's their job. They've done it so many times before. And so, you know, the secret lies in being able to quickly grasp the various ins and outs of commercial property so that you can start to reap the enormous rewards that you can get out of this part of the market.
That's great. Thank you. And I look forward to catching up with you again next week.
Yes, and me too, Ken.